I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 20 women now serve in the U.S. Senate, 4 Republicans and 16 Democrats. That's an all-time high. While Maryland's Barbara Mikulski is the longest-serving female in Senate history, Deb Fischer from Nebraska is the newcomer, elected last November. While these women don't agree on all the issues, they have forged a kind of sisterhood, having off-the-record meals together on a regular basis, and they have greater clout as heads of a number of important Senate committees. Our guest Jill Lawrence has a story in National Journal this month about what these women have achieved, how they approach their job and each other, and the issues facing the country. Jill Lawrence is national correspondent at the National Journal. Her July 12th cover story in the magazine is titled, Do Women Make Better Senators Than Men? And she joins us from the studios of Atlantic Media. And Jill, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. This is not a homogenous group. Yes, they are all women, but they're not all alike. How are they different?
Well, they're different in age. They range from early 40s to Dianne Feinstein just turned 80. So that's almost twice the age of some of the younger ones. And they also have extremely different politics. I mean, they range from Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, right, and Deb Fischer of Nebraska, who are Tea Party favorites. And then Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, who are Northern California liberals. So they really span the spectrum.
But somehow they have forged this, I don't want to overuse the word sisterhood during this hour, but they have forged an interesting relationship with each other.
Well, they have. I mean, it comes from being a minority within the Senate, and it also, I think, has something to do with Barbara Mikulski's sense of solidarity. She's the dean of the women, and she takes it very seriously, this responsibility to kind of orient them to the ways of the Senate and how to run your office and who to talk to for advice. She's not the only one, but she's the convener. You know, she recently brought in all the women to hear about the latest developments in sexual assaults in the military, what legislation there was, where people were positioning themselves, and what was happening in the various committees and subcommittees. So she you know, she also organizes the meeting, the dinners, and she was extremely helpful on this article because it was very tough to get all these women together, but we did it.
How long have these dinners been going on?
They've been going on for a long time, since almost 20 years.
Wow.
They were originally the brainchild of Mikulski and Kay Bailey Hutchison, who retired in January, the Texas Republican. So they've been going on for a while, but the attendance, you know, there used to be only a handful of them. So they used to be very intimate affairs. Now there's 20 people, and they have them sometimes at the Capitol, sometimes in restaurants, sometimes at each other's homes. And they really run the gamut conversationally. You know, they talk about problems they've had at work. They talk about their kids and juggling family and career. They talk about legislation, and they, one thing they say they talk about is their passions. It's not supposed to be some kind of a lobbying session, but you can determine what people are interested in and where there might be common ground. And so a lot of alliances get started there.
And interestingly, they don't have their aides with them. Obviously, they don't have the press with them or cameras. I mean, these are really largely off-the-record conversations.
Well, they're completely private, and no one has ever broken the rule. And they're almost always no men. The only time they say they made an exception was their last one, which was at the White House with President Obama.
He invited them over.
He did. It was at the suggestion of Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. And they, as they say, they were setting their sights high. They wouldn't go with just any man, but the president, that'd be okay.
They'd make an exception for him.
Right, right.
But do you think, I mean, can we say these women, these 20 women, diverse 20 women in many ways, do have a relationship with each other?
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's kind of an extra political relationship for the most part, although there are issues where they do come together. For instance, sexual assault in the military. There are some issues that just don't go along partisan lines. Some of the economic issues, some of the health issues, you know, there are places where they can find common ground, they do. And they're very supportive of one another, regardless of the politics. Dianne Feinstein has invited everyone from Hillary Clinton to Deb Fischer to lunch to discuss, you know, how to run a Senate office and, you know, how she runs her constituent offices in a big state in California. And this is advice they can take or not, but they know that there's someone there to help.
I mean, it's almost a cliche about women, right? The women are relational. They, you know, they know each other when each other's having a baby shower or something like that. It's interesting to think of these stereotypes and to kind of see it being played on in the U.S. Senate.
Well, it's true. And to be honest, the whole genesis of this story was a story that I saw on ABC News website. It was from the time of, I guess it was January, when this new record high of 20 people came in. And it was just filled with quotes from almost all 20 of them talking about essentially what superior beings they were. You know, they were going to make the Senate work better. They were consensus builders. They were more pragmatic. They knew how to listen to people. You know, they could cooperate. They could compromise. And there were even some who kind of went there to the stereotype of, you know, we've made dinner for six kids who all want different things. You know, this sort of bringing up of women's traditional responsibilities in the home to prove that they would be better at herding the cats of the Senate and that sort of thing. And so I kind of got my back up about that and thought, well, I'm going to just investigate this a little bit and see if it's true. And I mean, it does turn out to be true that they do operate like that, but it also turns out to be true that a lot of men do too, and there are reasons for that, some having to do with the Senate itself and the institutional incentives. You know, you can't really get anything done unless you're listening to other people and coming to some compromises and consensus.
Well, in fact, you touch on McCain-Feingold as an interesting example of a Republican and a Democrat working together on SCHIP. You've got Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch working together as well. So examples that this isn't just girls.
No, I mean, the biggest example most recently was immigration, which was eight guys. And it was four Democrats and four Republicans, and they got it done in the Senate. So, I mean, that was immediately kind of, you know, a counterpoint to what the women were saying.
But are the women wrong? I mean, it is interesting that they do seem to have, and I don't want to make too much of this, these get-togethers, and it seems like get-togethers where they might operate differently or talk differently than the men who are getting together.
Well, if you ask them about whether the men do it, they start laughing and they talk about the gym, and they say the men meet at the gym, and this is the
case. Not that there's anything wrong with that, right?
No, but you know, the fact that there's 80 men means they can't really have intimate dinners, and it also means that they self-select when they talk. And if they're talking at the gym, they may not be talking at length about their families or some, you know, issue they care about. It may be more casual. It's not the same kind of relationships. Now, there are things like the Senate group house that where Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin live, along with Representative George Miller. But those are three liberal Democrats. So, you know, it's the women have something special going on. I mean, maybe we'll see how it develops as more and more women join the Senate. You know, when they get to be 50 women, you know, in the next century,
right,
after we're long gone, I mean,
exactly,
will they still be having these intimate get-togethers? I'm not sure it'll be possible. Or will they be breaking down into groups that have more in common politically with each other? I'm sorry, I was just going to say, you know, this is kind of the conclusion of the people who follow the history of the Senate. It's just too soon to say whether they're different and better.
And we are talking about 20 women, but we are talking about largely Democratic women. We're talking about 16 Democrats and 4 Republicans.
Right, and that's another reason for the cohesiveness.
Explain.
Well, you know, they have a lot in common, and two of the Republicans are moderate Republicans who often partner with Democrats on bills. So you do have people with a lot in common, and there aren't too many schisms among the Democrats, although there is one right at the moment between Claire McCaskill and Kirsten Gillibrand over how to handle sexual assaults in the military. But, you know, on 9 out of 10 issues, they'll agree. And the people who don't fit this mold, Ayotte and Deb Fisher, are still comfortable in the group just because there's such a personal aspect to it. So it works. But one of the reasons that analysts give for why it's such a cohesive group is that so many of them are Democrats, and the Democratic agenda is so, you know, it fits so nicely with what some of these women are trying to get accomplished in Congress.
It's easier to get along with people who agree with you.
Yeah, it certainly is.
But it is interesting to, I mean, this is the Senate we're talking about, but it's interesting to look at the House. I think there's something like 81 women in the House. Whether that's a branch of government or an institution in government that would foster this same kind of relationship building.
Well, it is very different. Nancy Pelosi had a little round table last week with about 12 women reporters, and I was one of them. And she and Rosa DeLauro were talking about a women's economic empowerment agenda that they were putting together, and they talked about it in terms of how they'd love to get Republicans on board with it. But when we asked, they had not approached any Republicans to do it with them, including any Republican women, and in fact pointed out that whenever things were coming up that might alienate women, they put a Republican woman in charge of the floor debate or in some leadership role on the legislation so that, it, you know, to take the edge off of it, so to speak. So there were really, you know, and the way that the House operates, there's no power for the minority. And so Democrats really have to, they have no power. They have the power of the mouthpiece, you know, they have the microphone, and that's about it.
But I wonder if you're saying that we're talking about a minority of women in the Senate. There are other minority, you know, there's the other minorities within the Senate as well, and whether they sort of operate similarly, whether they are African American, although there probably aren't too many in the U.S. Senate, or other minority groups there as well.
You mean whether they are cohesive?
Yes.
Well, the Democratic women in the House are very cohesive, but they don't have any alliances with Republican women in the House, and there aren't that many Republican women in the House. So there's very little cross-party alliance in the House, and the agendas are so divergent at this point that really there's the only way to get things done in the House is through grassroots pressure from the outside, and that's what Nancy Pelosi was talking about. It's not going to work because the things that she wants to happen, like a raise and an increase in the minimum wage, are just, you know, considered by Republicans to be bad for business, or, you know, whatever reasons they have for that they don't want to spend extra money, they don't want to do paid family leave. And in the Senate, you know, there's a lot more common ground that can be found. And the other thing is that in the Senate, you have a lot of Democratic women heading committees where the issues are not these traditional women's issues. So they can also reach across the aisle and among women and also men to find common ground on things like the agriculture bill, say, or a transportation infrastructure bill.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Jill Lawrence is our guest today on the show. She's a national correspondent at National Journal, and we're talking about a cover story just a week or so ago titled, Do Women Make Better Senators Than Men? There are now 20 women in the U.S. Senate, 16 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'd be curious about your answer to that question. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents Michael Feinstein and Tony Award winners Christine Ebersole and Betty Buckley in an evening of Broadway and the American Songbook's greatest hits, Friday, August 2nd. A night with the ambassador of the American Songbook and two Broadway legends that the whole family can enjoy. Tickets for Michael Feinstein and Friends, Friday, August 2nd, and all Mann concerts are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
I'm Jesse Thorne. A lawyer, a writer, a psychiatrist, and a theater professor got together to write a humor book about earning your MBA on the toilet.
The original like goal was that no person could learn one meaningful thing from this book. That would have to be like a certainty of it. But that didn't turn out to be the most useful way to write.
Comedy group Casper Hauser on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a new novel tells the real-life story of the career-minded mad woman who coined the slogan, "A diamond is forever," and sold countless rings.
She really created these romantic ideas that we now associate with diamonds, but she herself was not romantic in any way. It didn't interest her.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The first woman in the U.S. Senate served for just 24 hours. That was back in 1922. Today, there are 20 women in the U.S. Senate, 16 Democrats and 4 Republicans. And if you're just joining us, Jill Lawrence is our guest, national correspondent for National Journal. Her cover story earlier this month was titled, Do Women Make Better Senators Than Men? And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jill, is it too early to answer that question?
It is too early. We've only had 20 senators, 20 women in the Senate since January. And before that, we've just had tiny numbers of women. And so, you know, you could certainly find 20 men in the Senate who are bipartisan, have bipartisan leanings, have worked with partners across the aisle. So it's going to take some time, and it's going to take some numbers, greater numbers, before we can tell whether they're actually different. And you know, even the women who are doing well in terms of formulating these bills. For instance, Debbie Stabenow, who for 2 years running has been able to produce an agriculture bill, which is a major, major undertaking. Mm-hmm. The House has been killing all this. So Congress is fairly dysfunctional, and women aren't the cure-all, that's for sure.
But would it be fair to say that some of these quote-unquote women's issues have become, over time, and maybe with the presence of some of these women in the Senate, they've become everybody's issues?
That is certainly the case. The real difference that the diversity has made is in the issue agenda. And there's a researcher at Georgetown who's done all the statistics, and basically, she found that a third of the agenda in Congress now has to do with issues that once were considered women's issues, education, health, abortion, child care, that sort of thing. But when women first started making their presence felt, these were really the concerns that had not risen to the level of anything happening. Even things as basic as women being included in clinical trials at the National Institutes of Health so that they could have access to new medications and treatments. That wasn't happening. Homemakers couldn't have IRAs. There was no family leave provision. You could lose your job if you had to take care of a newborn for a few weeks. So, you know, they've made a huge difference both in the way our laws now work and in the things that concern men and women who are in the work in Congress.
Is it possible to say, though, what they have accomplished? And I realize things are complicated in Congress with the House and the Senate. But when you look at these 20 women, what would you say their signature achievement has been so far?
That's an interesting question.
That was an interesting pause on your part. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can say, for instance, that Debbie Stabenow has had major achievements in these ag bills, but they haven't gone anywhere yet. Barbara Boxer has had a couple of bills come out of her Environment and Public Works committees, and they've they've had bipartisan support. They're not major. They've made some of the trains run on time as much as you can in the Senate, and that's an achievement. The sexual assault in the military situation, that is probably the most high-profile issue with the most across-the-board support from the women in the Senate. And there's 7 of them on the Armed Services Committee who were questioning the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that was pretty spectacular. That's never happened before. And so this issue is in the spotlight the way it never has been. And if they actually accomplish something major on it, that will be a big achievement, because it's been a real deterrent for women in the military.
And would you say the fact that a number of these women are heading up some of these committees, that to have those key appointments just gives them that much more clout to move issues along or highlight issues?
It sure does. I mean, they're doing just all kinds of things on consumer issues and some of the nuts and bolts of running the government. Barbara Mikulski is chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and she's been getting continuing resolutions out, which are what keeps the government funded in the absence of you know, a formal budget and appropriations bills. But and Patty Murray is the chairman of the budget committee. Now, there's an interesting situation because she managed to get a budget out of her committee for the first time in 3 years, and it only had Democratic votes. The Democrats consider that a real achievement nevertheless because there's such a divergence just even among the Democrats on how to what to spend money on. But now it's been passed by Democrats in the Senate, and Republicans in the Senate are refusing to let it go into negotiations with the House. And so Barbara Mikulski is relying on Susan Collins and to help try to press for negotiations because this is the way the government's supposed to work.
But this is, it's supposed to work, are the gears more clogged up this go-around, as you observe, just how the Senate is supposed to work?
Well, the Senate is kind of in the grips of a lot of filibuster fever on the part of Republicans, and every once in a while there'll be a deal to unclog the situation, and we just had one of those, and President Obama is going to get 7 of his nominees voted on. But, you know, that was a deal that was worked out by men, so you have men actually behaving well and making the Senate move forward. It's really, you know, the women are in a good place to try to make things happen in the Senate, but it's very frustrating with the House being the way it is now because there's no incentive for Republicans who control the House to compromise with anyone. The minority doesn't have the power to block anything or stop anything. And so, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who was the first woman speaker, is now reduced to talking about grassroots power and maybe Republicans will listen to it. And the sort of subtext is at least we'll have an issue in the midterms.
And that's Jill Lawrence, national correspondent for National Journal. And we're talking about the Senate and the fact that there are 20 women serving in the Senate, 16 Democrats, 4 Republicans. We're talking about what they have and haven't accomplished and some of the expectations that they have and perhaps even others have about what they can do in the Senate. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'd be curious whether you would vote for someone based on their gender, whether they're a man or a woman. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-WHYY. Jill, you in this article that you had, or this cover story that you had, you did talk about some interesting things that some of these women have done. For instance, Barbara Boxer went to Senator Vitter's home state of Louisiana. Barbara Mikulski went to Senator Shelby's home state of Alabama. Why did they go, and what does that tell us?
Well, these two guys are the ranking Republicans, the senior Republicans on the committee that these women chair. So Barbara Boxer wanted to find out what was going on in New Orleans and other places in Louisiana where David Vitter comes from because they were working on a water bill, an Army Corps of Engineers bill together. And the idea is to hear firsthand from the constituents of these people, and it's kind of like a listening tour in a place, you know, in Barbara Boxer's case, in a place that's very different from Northern California. So you understand better what your senior Republican on your committee needs and where he's coming from. And it helps in terms of finding what Barbara Boxer calls the sweet spot when you're writing the legislation. And same is true for Barbara Mikulski, who went to Alabama. She also had gone to Texas when she and Kay Bailey Hutchison were on an appropriations subcommittee together. So you learn a lot about a culture that's different than yours and needs that are different than yours. And I think it's kind of like a goodwill gesture. Now, whether women do this more than men, the Senate Historian's Office was unable to conclusively figure that out. So, and certainly they all go on trips together, men and women, overseas, and they have field hearings out in different states together. So there's, you know, some getting out of your comfort zone that may not apply solely to women. But it is, you know, it is a hallmark of good legislating to be able to listen to and understand the needs of the other side.
Well, and when one talks about women and having this interest in relationships and being willing to work together, I always think of Margaret Thatcher, you know, who was Margaret Thatcher? I mean, you always have to be careful about applying some of these criteria to women, broadly speaking.
Well, that's absolutely true. And, you know, there are people who said for this story that women don't have a Ted Cruz or a Rand Paul. They don't have a provocateur. Well, that's true, but they have Elizabeth Warren, who's who's not quite like that, but certainly no shrinking violet. And if Sarah Palin ever ran for the Senate, well, they'd have their own Ted Cruz.
How do you see Elizabeth Warren playing into this dynamic?
Well, she had such a cemented identity before she came to the Senate she's kind of stayed within her zone in terms of on the banking committee, holding banks and regulators to their feet to the fire and making sure that the consumers are protected. She didn't want to talk for this story, and she's trying to keep a low profile, and she hasn't been there for a very long time, so she's not chairing any committees. So she's more of a personality at this point and a persona, and a strong one for sure, and she's turning up on presidential lists, which is interesting.
To say the least.
And yeah. kind of in the same way that having Rand Paul, I guess, turn up on lists is interesting. These are people who don't fit the mold.
But as someone who has covered the U.S. Senate for some time now, just having 20 women there, does that change the dynamic? I mean, does it even look different for you as you cover it, or even do you find a different dynamic within the chamber itself?
I think part that there is, but part of it is also that they bring up issues that other people realize they should care about, and also over the years there's just been much more of a sensitivity, and you now have a president who's talking about universal pre-K. That was once a women's issue, so it's a different environment, and they've helped to make it that way, and they're continuing to. And then there are, of course, the kind of physical effects of having women there. They've had to finally accommodate them in terms of better and bigger restrooms.
Oh, is that right? Yay! That's
right.
Progress, right?
Exactly. The need finally outstripped what was available.
And are they nice bathrooms?
I haven't been in one, but I would assume that they're very nice. I mean, we're talking U.S. Senate. So
they get good stuff down there.
But,
yeah. What you're describing, though, is the way people used to describe the Senate of, let's say, a generation ago, when people seemed to know each other and families were there and they would socialize and they would, have drinks together and they knew about each other's children. Is that what we're talking about?
That's what women have recreated. It's like an era gone by. They tend to have their children with them in Washington. A lot of the men have families that live back in the States, more in the House than the Senate. But it's, that kind of turned, that's the way Washington was when people became anti-government. Mm-hmm. Then it became, we're leaving town on Thursday night, we're not coming back till Monday night, and they would leave their families at home. And that whole way of life disappeared. And there's also much more hardened partisanship, which makes it difficult in some cases to socialize. People really are not in compromise mode these days. And there's just resistance to everything, even after the fact. It was very unusual after Richard Cordray was confirmed as head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Lindsey Graham said, we were wrong to block him because we weren't blocking him because of him. We blocked him because we didn't like the agency he was going to run. This is very different. And that's the same with the Affordable Care Act. Things now are just so dug in. People are not taking no or yes for an answer. These agencies and laws are passed, enacted, part of the landscape, but that doesn't matter anymore.
But it seems that logjam was unjammed after there was a meeting in the old Senate. People apparently, reportedly, got to talk and say their piece, and somehow that was enough to allow these nominees to go forward.
Well, that's true, but we'll see what happens now, because there'll be other nominees, and that agreement did not apply to judicial nominees, and that you could argue is going to be the president's longest, deepest legacy that endures after he's gone, or will be if he can get who he wants onto some of these courts. So it's that was a good thing, but it was a very partial measure. And, you have people under pressure, including Mitch McConnell, who's being challenged by a Tea Party candidate in his primary. So that's part of it. The women seem to somehow be inured to that. Many of them are very popular, get reelected overwhelmingly, so they don't have to worry too much.
And how would you say, and I have to say to our listeners, because we'd hoped to be talking with Kirsten Kukowski about the Republican Party's initiative to get more Republican women to run. We can't seem to make contact with her. But let me ask you, Jill, it looks like the Republican Party is trying to figure out how to get, I guess, either more women to support Republican candidates or get more women to run. Do they have a problem, do you think, when it comes to women?
Well, in the Senate, you know, and in the House, there are far fewer. And, I mean, Democrats would tell you that's because their agenda is less appealing, but that's only part of the problem, if it is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I think what they're trying to do is start recruiting at very much lower levels, get people onto county commissions, into state legislatures, then running for larger, you know, statewide offices, and kind of put people in the pipeline so that they can rise up to Congress. And that's a very good thing to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I should say that in terms of how people vote, research shows that whether you're a man or a woman candidate makes very little difference to a voter. Most voters today are voting for the party and the philosophy, not you know, because they think a woman might do a better job or a man might do a better job.
Even though the fact that it looked like, I think, a majority of women voted for President Obama, does that worry you, think, the Republican Party? I realize you're not speaking for the Republican Party here. We, as I said, we'd hope to make connection with Kirsten Kukowski. Go ahead, Jill.
Yeah, I think that some in the Republican Party are worried about the messaging and how it affects women. You know, if the party comes across as harsh towards minorities or immigrants, that's a turnoff to moderates and moderate women in particular. So, I you see the schism playing out between what the national party says it wants to do in terms of recasting its image and going for immigration reform. And many senators, Republican senators, were involved in that effort. Mm-hmm. But then you also have other people in the Republican Party, like Representative Steve King, who has been casting a slur on the children of immigrants, calling them drug mules and drug dealers. You know, he says for every valedictorian, there's 100 people bringing drugs over the border. And, it kind of hurts the situation. You have the House Speaker and Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House, really harshly criticizing him for those statements, but you know, these are not the way to appeal to women.
Well, and to pick up on that, we're almost up in a break here, and we do have a guest waiting in the wings. Steve King did not back down on those comments. He sort of doubled down on them.
Well, it's true, he did, and that's not helpful
to what, his party?
Well, it's damaging to this effort for the Republicans to rebrand and kind of cast a much wider net and much wider appeal to voters and where they have deficits, which include both Hispanics and women.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Jill Lawrence. She's national correspondent for National Journal. And we do have a guest waiting in the wings to talk about the Republican Party's initiative to get more Republican women to run for office. And we want to hear from you. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
Tig Notaro used her comedy act to break the news she had cancer.
Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you?
It became one of the most talked about comedy sets of the past few years. It's just come out on CD. Our interview with Notaro about that performance on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Fruitvale Station and reality.
So many of these young men today are experiencing these killings without a face of their humanity.
That's Cephas Johnson, the uncle of Oscar Grant, whose death at the hand of a Bay Area police officer in 2009 is the story told in Fruitvale Station. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we've been talking about women in politics with our guest Jill Lawrence, national correspondent at the National Journal, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Joining us now is Sarah Izquez-Flores. She's Deputy Communications Director for the Republican National Committee. The RNC has a new initiative to get more Republican women into office called Women on the Right Unite. And Sarah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
What is the goal of Women on the Right Unite?
Well, it's all about finding more women, getting them from the ground up, you know, getting them to run for state legislative office, as y'all were discussing earlier, moving to Congress, moving to the Senate, and of course, eventually the White House. So we're excited to find more of these women, get better training, better mentorship, and provide them with the resources they need from the get-go.
And are you looking for women with certain political beliefs, or are you just looking for Republican women, broadly speaking?
Well, obviously, the conservative movement is one based on philosophical principles that we're not going to be wavering on, but the Republican Party is a big tent, so we're looking for conservatives across the board.
And what kind of, are we talking about women that need to be invited to run for office, or women that are kind of waiting on the wings and just need your assistance?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, I think that we've found through a variety of books and the conversations that we're having nationally about women's role in our economy and moving up in businesses, that often women do need to be invited to take that next promotion or encouraged by their mentors to take the next step. At the same time, there are plenty of women who I think are eager to run and just don't know what that next step is, and so we're going to try to help them as well. I mean, how do you start a finance committee? How do you create a town hall to go speak at and those sort of things. So it's both, I think.
And Jill, do you see it that way in terms of getting women to run for elective office?
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes women are unsure about doing this, possibly more often than men. They're reluctant. Tammy Baldwin, the new senator from Wisconsin, talks about a young woman who asked her whether she should run for state legislature. She wasn't sure she should do it because she had two young children. And Tammy Baldwin said to her, if you don't do it, then policy is going to be made by people who aren't caring for young children. So, you know, sometimes people need that push.
Back to you, Sarah. I mean, are there certain issues that you think can speak to Republican voters that these women can represent?
I'm a big believer that there aren't specific women's issues, that all issues are women's issues. But I do think that having female candidates is important, and that the way that women legislate, the way that they approach conversations, can be different and can get different results from time to time.
But do you think the Republican Party has a problem with women, or that women have a problem with the Republican Party?
I think that we did see women, particularly unmarried women, in the last election move more to the Democratic side. Of course, Romney won married women, and the Democrats did a very good job of a war on women, as they called it, and created a belief that Republicans were trying to do things that they weren't trying to do. I think, of course, you see that swinging back on them now with Filner and Wiener, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz hasn't condemned them, and so they have candidates and Democrats around the country who are now facing some serious issues with women. So maybe this is more of a pendulum, but obviously the Republican Party is taking this very seriously as far as our own efforts, and we want to make sure that women feel not just welcome in our party, but included in every aspect.
And I do want to talk about Wiener with you, Jill Lawrence, but let me go back to you, Sarah. But I'm thinking about Todd Akin's comments about legitimate rape. I mean, that couldn't have helped your party.
No, it didn't. And offensive comments don't help our party, and they don't help the other party either. And I think you will see men on both sides say things that they shouldn't say, and candidates always, you know, put their foot in their mouths from time to time. It was unfortunate what he said, and I think that women understand that that does not represent the beliefs of the Republican Party. It represents the beliefs of Todd Akin.
Do you think women are more well-behaved as elected officials?
Well, I don't want to generalize for across our gender, but I think we have seen, again, looking at Wiener and Filner and Spitzer, I don't see many of our female representatives having problems with social media.
Not yet, anyway. Well, Sarah, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you, Jill.
Great to talk.
And that says Sarah Izquierdo-Flores, and she is Deputy Communications Director for the Republican National Committee. Well, let me talk with you, Jill Lawrence, about Anthony Wiener, who I don't need to recap exactly where things stand with him. How do you understand his willingness to run for office and even run for office, continue to run for office this week? And I would say, and I just as an outside observer, essentially humiliating and being willing to be humiliated because of his texting and sexting as he runs for office for mayor of New York.
Well, I think his motivation is easier to explain than his wife's. He obviously is still ambitious and still somehow believes he has a lot to offer to voters in New York City. It's incomprehensible to me that someone with these types of personal problems would want to have a platform, you know, force them onto a public platform. And we've just seen unbelievable headlines and news stories in the press conference they had with his wife. And, you know, it's the polling shows that this is not, that he's not going anywhere. He's starting to sink. There's only been one poll since all this new news came out about additional sexting after he left Congress, and he's 9 points below Christine Quinn. So I don't think that he's going to survive in this race. And so then you have to ask yourself, what was it all for?
Well, I mean, I would assume anyone that runs for office has a big ego, but there seems to be almost a kind of exhibitionism, even in his running for office, beyond what he was doing on the internet.
I think that's right. And actually, you know, we now know that it wasn't just internet. He was having phone sex with one of these young women twice a week after he left Congress. This only ended last November. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of crazy. It really is. You know, there's now kind of ripples in New York with Hillary Clinton because, you know, her one of her top aides, somebody who she says is like a daughter to her, is Wiener's wife, Huma Abedin.
Yes.
And she's been soliciting money from Clinton supporters for her husband's campaign. So you have to ask yourself, you know, how far is this going to go before somebody stops it?
Well, and I'm always hesitant to judge people's relationships because I do believe you don't necessarily or ever really know what goes on between two people. But, it was sort of shocking, frankly, to see her standing by her man and speaking for her man.
Yeah, you know, the other situation in New York is the Elliott Spitzer race, and one of the tabloid headlines this morning was Splitzer, because the New York Post is reporting that that Silda Spitzer, who is living apart from her husband, is now telling friends that she's going to divorce him when this campaign is over. He's running for controller, and she the reason she's giving, if this reporting is reliable, mm-hmm. is that this public campaign and sort of this refocus of attention onto their problems is just too much for her.
Yeah. Well, even I was watching, the Colbert and the Daily Show this week, and it was all about Carlos Danger. And again, you know, it's just such catnip for headlines and for shows like that.
And the New Yorker cover next week.
Oh, really? I haven't seen that yet.
Yes, he's on it. A cartoon of Carlos Danger.
That's Jill Lawrence. We're talking about politics. So today on Radio Time, spending most of the hour talking about women in politics, but it's hard to avoid talking about what's going on in New York. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. But it is interesting to think about, you know, Mark Stanford and David Vitter. It's not like the Democrats have a lock on some of these scandals or public public humiliations.
No, it's not. Although I actually interviewed some religion experts because I found it so fascinating. There's much more of a tradition of redemption and forgiveness among evangelicals than, say, Catholics or Jews. So, you know, when Mark Sanford and David Vitter went to the voters, yeah, they're very quick to talk about sin and the sinner, but they also are very quick to forgive. And of course, there's also the so that is a difference. You know, I think that Wiener in New York is trying to get along on audacity and nerve and guts and just kind of muscle his way through it. I'm not sure, particularly when you have a second act like he's having, how much forgiveness is going to be there for him.
Well, especially when one can read, you know, emails and texts and see pictures. I mean, we didn't see pictures with David Vitter or Mark Sanford.
No, and I mean, in a way, you know, okay, using a prostitute or falling in love with somebody and really handling it badly is different than what happened with Anthony Weiner. There's some kind of, you know, psychology to this that I don't understand but doesn't seem right.
Doesn't seem right. Well, again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Even with Huma Ahmadin, who's his wife, as you said, has a very strong connection to the Clinton family. Bill Clinton married them. She has worked for Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. How do you see this relationship?
You mean between Huma and Hillary?
Yeah, or the Clintons.
Yeah, I, you know, first of all, if Hillary Clinton runs for president and Huma's a part of it, that won't be for a year and a half. So maybe this will all be in the past. But I think that this run for office and her sticking by her man is really testing that relationship with the Clintons. I mean, their donors are stepping up to help him, even though, you know, that may not be their preference, but they're very loyal. And so, you know, until there's some reporting this morning that until Huma steps away from him, the donors won't stop the spigot. So it's all very complicated. There's also the fact that apparently Huma did not tell Hillary Clinton that there was going to be this press conference, and Hillary Clinton found out about it when she turned on the TV, and there it was. And, you know, the echoes of so many of the things that happened to Hillary Clinton herself, you know, 60 Minutes in 1992, you know, trying to attest to her husband's character despite problems in their marriage, and then the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal, you know, this cannot be pleasant for her to have all these memories brought up.
Well, indeed not. But it is interesting. I mean, here's New York City, maybe the most powerful mayor's position in the world to try to run that city. And it's kind of devolved into this really sort of murky, yicky kind of mess.
Well, that's true. Can't imagine Michael Bloomberg in this sort of a fix. but, you know, I think it's mostly a Wiener problem, and if he were to drop out of the race, it would become much more of a regular issues-oriented race. I mean, but of course, it did start out a little bit strange with Christine Quinn's autobiography all about her bulimia. It's, you know, someone called it the too much information primary. I mean, it's kind of a little bit that way, I think. Some things you just don't need to know.
Too much information, indeed. Well, let me steer you back to Washington. And even, I know you had a piece today in the National Journal about President Clinton, I guess, going, sort of, in a sense, out on the road, perhaps trying to do an end run around Congress. What do you see for the next couple of weeks in Congress?
Well, they're about to leave town.
Right.
So some quiet time. Some quiet time for us. Now, they're going to be going back to their constituents. I'd love to be a fly on the wall at Senator McCain's constituent meetings, because I'm not sure what his Republican constituents are going to think about the role that he's now once again playing in Washington. But, you know, they're going to be going with an economic showdown in the offing, a fiscal showdown in the offing when they come back over all kinds of, you know, the budget and debt matters. And, you know, there are some people who are still holding out for a grand bargain, which would involve entitlement reforms and cuts and maybe some restructuring of the tax code. So it's really unclear, you know, whether we're going to get some kind of constructive mm-hmm. action. That's kind of the long odds. And the short ones are probably a government shutdown while they fight it out.
Really?
Yeah. That seems to be where they're headed.
Oh, dear. Deja vu all over again.
Right.
But do you also anticipate, and I remember those very feisty town meetings of a couple of years ago, thinking about issues about immigration and some other hot-button issues. Do you anticipate some fireworks at some of these town meetings that elected representatives tend to hold in August?
Oh, I definitely think that's going to happen. And, I mean, Republicans in particular are kind of stoking that sort of thing with, once again, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and immigration is certainly a hot-button issue. And there's even so much abortion activity going on out in the states. And I don't think that there's any way that anybody can avoid controversy at these meetings. It'll be interesting to see whether the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare emotions are as inflamed as they were. I mean, that's kind of the goal of some of the Republicans, to get that moving as an issue that'll help them the way it did in 2010, which is kind of the biggest nightmare for Democrats. So I think we'll have a better idea after August and the meetings what kind of role that's going to play next year.
Well, as always, Jill Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks a lot for having me.
You're very welcome. She's national correspondent at the National Journal, talking about politics and women in politics. She had a cover story earlier this month, Do Women Make Better Senators Than Men? And I think time will only tell on the answer to that question. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Stay with us. We got hour two waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.